Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 2. Many economists have asserted that there is substantial, perhaps overwhelming evidence, that total welfare in capitalist United States, for example, would be increased by a reallocation of resources to the public sector. More schoolrooms and fewer shopping centers. More public libraries and fewer automobiles. More hospitals and fewer bowling alleys. This means that some men must toil all their lives without adequate transportation, automobiles, without an adequate number of places to buy the goods they need, shopping centers, without the pleasures of relaxation, bowling alleys, in order that other men may be provided with schools, libraries, and hospitals. If you want to see the ultimate results and full meaning of the tribal view of wealth, the total obliteration of the distinction between private action and government action, between production and force, the total obliteration of the concept of rights of an individual human being's reality, and its replacement by a view of men as interchangeable beasts of burden or factors of production, study the following. Capitalism has a bias against the public sector for two reasons. First, all products and income accrue, initially, to the private sector, while resources reach the public sector through the painful process of taxation. Public needs are met only by sufferance of consumers in their role as taxpayers. What about producers, whose political representatives are acutely conscious of their constituents' tender feelings about taxation? That people know better than governments what to do with their income is a notion more appealing than the contrary one, that people get more for their tax money than for other types of spending. By what theory of values? By whose judgment? Second, the pressure of private business to sell leads to the formidable array of devices of modern salesmanship which influence consumer choice and bias consumer values toward private consumption. This means that your desire to spend the money you earn rather than have it taken away from you is a mere bias. Hence, much private expenditure goes for wants that are not very urgent in any fundamental sense. Urgent? To whom? Which wants are fundamental beyond a cave, a bearskin, and a chunk of raw meat? The corollary is that many public needs are neglected because these superficial private wants, artificially generated, compete successfully for the same resources. Whose resources? A comparison of resource allocation to the public and private sectors under capitalism and under socialist collectivism is illuminating. It is. In a collective economy, all resources operate in the public sector and are available for education, defense, health, welfare, and other public needs without any transfer through taxation. Private consumption is restricted to the claims that are permitted, by whom, against the social product, much as public services in a capitalist economy are limited to the claims permitted against the private sector. In a collective economy, public needs enjoy the same sort of built-in priority that private consumption enjoys in a capitalist economy. In the Soviet Union, teachers are plentiful, but automobiles are scarce, whereas the opposite condition prevails in the United States. Here is the conclusion of that article. Predictions concerning the survival of capitalism are in part a matter of definition. One sees everywhere in capitalist countries a shifting of economic activity from the private to the public sphere. At the same time, after World War II, private consumption appeared destined to increase in communist countries, such as the consumption of wheat. The two economic systems seem to be drawing closer together by changes converging from both directions, yet significant differences in the economic structures still existed. It seemed reasonable to assume that the society which invested more in people would advance more rapidly and inherit the future. In this important respect, capitalism, in the eyes of some economists, labors under a fundamental but not inescapable disadvantage in competition with collectivism. The collectivization of Soviet agriculture was achieved by means of a government-planned famine, planned and carried out deliberately to force peasants into collective farming. Soviet Russia's enemies claim that 15 million peasants died in that famine. The Soviet government admits the death of 7 million. At the end of World War II, Soviet Russia's enemies claimed that 30 million people were doing forced labor in Soviet concentration camps and were dying of planned malnutrition, human lives being cheaper than food. Soviet Russia's apologists admit to the figure of 12 million people. This is what the Encyclopedia Britannica refers to as investment in people. In a culture where such a statement is made with intellectual impunity and with an aura of moral righteousness, the guiltiest men are not the collectivists. The guiltiest men are those who, lacking the courage to challenge mysticism or altruism, attempt to bypass the issues of reason and morality and to defend the only rational and moral system in mankind's history, capitalism, on any grounds other than rational and moral. Chapter 2, The Roots of War, by Ayn Rand. It is said that nuclear weapons have made wars too horrible to contemplate. Yet every nation on earth feels, in helpless terror, that such a war might come. The overwhelming majority of mankind, the people who die on the battlefields, or starve and perish among the ruins, do not want war. They never wanted it. Yet wars have kept erupting throughout the centuries, like a long trail of blood underscoring mankind's history. Men are afraid that war might come because they know consciously or subconsciously that they have never rejected the doctrine which causes wars, which has caused the wars of the past and can do it again, the doctrine that it is right or practical or necessary for men to achieve their goals by means of physical force, by initiating the use of force against other men, and that some sort of good can justify it. It is the doctrine that force is a proper or unavoidable part of human existence and human societies. Observe one of the ugliest characteristics of today's world, the mixture of frantic war preparations with hysterical peace propaganda, and the fact that both come from the same source, from the same political philosophy. The bankrupt yet still dominant political philosophy of our age is statism. Observe the nature of today's alleged peace movements. Professing love and concern for the survival of mankind, they keep screaming that the nuclear weapons race should be stopped, that armed force should be abolished as a means of settling disputes among nations, and that war should be outlawed in the name of humanity. Yet these same peace movements do not oppose dictatorships. The political views of their members range through all shades of the statist spectrum, from welfare statism to socialism to fascism to communism. This means that they are opposed to the use of coercion by one nation against another, but not by the government of a nation against its own citizens. It means that they are opposed to the use of force against armed adversaries, but not against the disarmed. Consider the plunder, the destruction, the starvation, the brutality, the slave labor camps, the torture chambers, the wholesale slaughter perpetrated by dictatorships. Yet this is what today's alleged peace lovers are willing to advocate or tolerate in the name of love for humanity. It is obvious that the ideological root of statism, or collectivism, is the tribal premise of primordial savages who, unable to conceive of individual rights, believed that the tribe is a supreme, omnipotent ruler, that it owns the lives of its members and may sacrifice them whenever it pleases to whatever it deems to be its own good. Unable to conceive of any social principles save the rule of brute force, they believed that the tribe's wishes are limited only by its physical power, and that other tribes are its natural prey to be conquered, looted, enslaved, or annihilated. The history of all primitive peoples is a succession of tribal wars and intertribal slaughter. That this savage ideology now rules nations armed with nuclear weapons should give pause to anyone concerned with mankind's survival. Statism is a system of institutionalized violence and perpetual civil war. It leaves men no choice but to fight to seize political power, to rob or be robbed, to kill or be killed. when brute force is the only criterion of social conduct, and unresisting surrender to destruction is the only alternative, even the lowest of men, even an animal, even a cornered rat will fight. There can be no peace within an enslaved nation. The bloodiest conflicts of history were not wars between nations, but civil wars between men of the same nation, who could find no peaceful recourse to law, principle, or justice. Observe that the history of all absolute states is punctuated by bloody uprisings, by violent eruptions of blind despair without ideology, program, or goals, which were usually put down by ruthless extermination. In a full dictatorship, statism's chronic cold civil war takes the form of bloody purges when one gang deposes another, as in Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. In a mixed economy, it takes the form of pressure group warfare, each group fighting for legislation to extort its own advantages by force from all other groups. The degree of statism in a country's political system is the degree to which it breaks up the country into rival gangs and sets men against one another. When individual rights are abrogated, there is no way to determine who is entitled to what. There is no way to determine the justice of anyone's claims, desires, or interests. The criterion, therefore, reverts to the tribal concept of one's wishes are limited only by the power of one's gang. In order to survive under such a system, men have no choice but to fear, hate, and destroy one another. It is a system of underground plotting, of secret conspiracies, of deals, favors, betrayals, and sudden bloody coups. It is not a system conducive to brotherhood, security, cooperation, and peace. Statism, in fact and in principle, is nothing more than gang rule. A dictatorship is a gang devoted to looting the effort of the productive citizens of its own country. When a statist ruler exhausts his own country's economy, he attacks his neighbors. It is his only means of postponing internal collapse and prolonging his rule. A country that violates the rights of its own citizens will not respect the rights of its neighbors. Those who do not recognize individual rights will not recognize the rights of nations. A nation is only a number of individuals. Statism needs war. A free country does not. Statism survives by looting. A free country survives by production. Observe that the major wars of history were started by the more controlled economies of the time against the freer ones. For instance, World War I was started by monarchist Germany and Tsarist Russia, who dragged in their freer allies. World War II was started by the alliance of Nazi Germany with Soviet Russia and their joint attack on Poland. Observe that in World War II, both Germany and Russia seized and dismantled entire factories in conquered countries to ship them home, while the freest of the mixed economies, the semi-capitalistic United States, sent billions worth of lend-lease equipment, including entire factories, to its allies. Germany and Russia needed war. The United States did not, and gained nothing. In fact, the United States lost economically, even though it won the war. It was left with an enormous national debt, augmented by the grotesquely futile policy of supporting former allies and enemies to this day. Yet it is capitalism that today's peace lovers oppose and statism that they advocate, in the name of peace. Laissez-faire capitalism is the only social system based on the recognition of individual rights, and therefore the only system that bans force from social relationships. By the nature of its basic principles and interests, it is the only system fundamentally opposed to war. Men who are free to produce have no incentive to loot. They have nothing to gain from war and a great deal to lose. Ideologically, the principle of individual rights does not permit a man to seek his own livelihood at the point of a gun, inside or outside his country. Economically, wars cost money. In a free economy where wealth is privately owned, the costs of war come out of the income of private citizens. There is no overblown public treasury to hide that fact, and a citizen cannot hope to recoup his own financial losses, such as taxes or business dislocations or property destruction, by winning the war. Thus, his own economic interests are on the side of peace. In a statist economy where wealth is publicly owned, a citizen has no economic interests to protect by preserving peace. He is only a drop in the common bucket, while war gives him the fallacious hope of larger handouts from his masters. Ideologically, he is trained to regard men as sacrificial animals. He is one himself. He can have no concept of why foreigners should not be sacrificed on the same public altar for the benefit of the same state. The trader and the warrior have been fundamental antagonists throughout history. Trade does not flourish on battlefields. Factories do not produce under bombardments. Profits do not grow on rubble. Capitalism is a society of traders, for which it has been denounced by every would-be gunman who regards trade as selfish and conquest as noble. Let those who are actually concerned with peace observe that capitalism gave mankind the longest period of peace in history, a period during which there were no wars involving the entire civilized world, from the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 to the outbreak of World War I in 1914. It must be remembered that the political systems of the 19th century were not pure capitalism, but mixed economies. The element of freedom, however, was dominant. It was as close to a century of capitalism as mankind has come. But the element of statism kept growing throughout the 19th century, and by the time it blasted the world in 1914, the governments involved were dominated by statist policies. Just as, in domestic affairs, all the evils caused by statism and government controls were blamed on capitalism and the free market, so in foreign affairs, all the evils of statist policies were blamed on and ascribed to capitalism. Such myths as capitalistic imperialism, war profiteering, or the notion that capitalism has to win markets by military conquest are examples of the superficiality or the unscrupulousness of statist commentators and historians. The essence of capitalism's foreign policy is free trade, i.e., the abolition of trade barriers, of protective tariffs, of special privileges, the opening of the world's trade routes to free international exchange and competition among the private citizens of all countries dealing directly with one another. During the 19th century, it was free trade that liberated the world, undercutting and wrecking the remnants of feudalism and the statist tyranny of absolute monarchies. As with Rome, the world accepted the British Empire because it opened world channels of energy for commerce in general. Though repressive status, government was still imposed to a considerable degree on Ireland, with very bad results. On the whole, England's invisible exports were law and free trade. Practically speaking, while England ruled the seas, any man of any nation could go anywhere, taking his goods and money with him in safety. As in the case of Rome, when the repressive element of England's mixed economy grew to become her dominant policy and turned her to statism, her empire fell apart. It was not military force that had held it together. Capitalism wins and holds its markets by free competition, at home and abroad. A market conquered by war can be of value temporarily only to those advocates of a mixed economy who seek to close it to international competition, impose restrictive regulations, and thus acquire special privileges by force. The same type of businessmen who sought special advantages by government action in their own countries sought special markets by government action abroad. At whose expense? At the expense of the overwhelming majority of businessmen who paid the taxes for such ventures but gained nothing. Who justified such policies and sold them to the public? The statist intellectuals who manufactured such doctrines as the public interest or national prestige or manifest destiny. The actual war profiteers of all mixed economies were and are of that type, men with political pull who acquire fortunes by government favor during or after a war, fortunes which they could not have acquired on a free market. Remember that private citizens, whether rich or poor, whether businessmen or workers, have no power to start a war. That power is the exclusive prerogative of a government. Which type of government is more likely to plunge a country into war? A government of limited powers, bound by constitutional restrictions, or an unlimited government open to the pressure of any group with warlike interests or ideologies, a government able to command armies to march at the whim of a single chief executive. Yet it is not a limited government that today's peace lovers are advocating. Needless to say, unilateral pacifism is merely an invitation to aggression. Just as an individual has the right of self-defense, so has a free country if attacked. But this does not give its government the right to draft men into military service, which is the most blatantly statist violation of a man's right to his own life. There is no contradiction between the moral and the practical. A volunteer army is the most efficient army, as many military authorities have testified. A free country has never lacked volunteers when attacked by a foreign aggressor. But not many men would volunteer for such ventures as Korea or Vietnam. Without drafted armies, the foreign policies of statist or mixed economies would not be possible. So long as a country is even semi-free, its mixed economy profiteers are not the source of its warlike influences or policies, and are not the primary cause of its involvement in war. They are merely political scavengers cashing in on a public trend. The primary cause of that trend is the mixed economy intellectuals. Observe the link between statism and militarism in the intellectual history of the 19th and 20th centuries. Just as the destruction of capitalism and the rise of the totalitarian state were not caused by business or labor or any economic interests, but by the dominant statist ideology of the intellectuals, so the resurgence of the doctrines of military conquest and armed crusades for political ideals were the product of the same intellectuals' belief that the good is to be achieved by force. The rise of a spirit of nationalistic imperialism in the United States did not come from the right, but from the left. Not from big business interests, but from the collectivist reformers who influenced the policies of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. For a history of these influences, see The Decline of American Liberalism by Arthur A. Ekirk, Jr. In such instances, writes Professor Ekirk, as the progressives' increasing acceptance of compulsory military training and of the white man's burden, there were obvious reminders of the paternalism of much of their economic reform legislation. Imperialism, according to a recent student of American foreign policy, was a revolt against many of the values of traditional liberalism. The spirit of imperialism was an exaltation of duty above rights, of collective welfare above individual self-interest, the heroic values as opposed to materialism, action instead of logic, the natural impulse rather than the pallid intellect. In regard to Woodrow Wilson, Professor Ekirk writes, Wilson no doubt would have preferred the growth of United States foreign trade to come about as a result of free international competition, but he found it easy with his ideas of moralism and duty to rationalize direct American intervention as a means of safeguarding the national interest. And he, Wilson, seemed to feel that the United States had a mission to spread its institutions, which he conceived as liberal and democratic, to the more benighted areas of the world. It was not the advocates of capitalism who helped Wilson to whip up a reluctant, peace-loving nation into the hysteria of a military crusade. It was the liberal magazine The New Republic. Its editor, Herbert Croly, used such arguments as, "The American nation needs the tonic of a serious moral adventure." Just as Wilson, a liberal reformer, led the United States into World War I to make the world safe for democracy, so Franklin D. Roosevelt, another liberal reformer, led it into World War II in the name of the Four Freedoms. In both cases, the conservatives and the big business interests were overwhelmingly opposed to war, but were silenced. In the case of World War II, they were smeared as isolationists, reactionaries, and America firsters. World War I led not to democracy, but to the creation of three dictatorships: Soviet Russia, Fascist Italy, Nazi Germany. World War II led not to four freedoms, but to the surrender of one-third of the world's population into communist slavery. If peace were the goal of today's intellectuals, a failure of that magnitude, and the evidence of unspeakable suffering on so large a scale, would make them pause and check their statist premises. Instead, blind to everything but their hatred for capitalism, they are now asserting that poverty breeds wars, and justifying war by sympathizing with a material greed of that kind. But the question is, what breeds poverty? If you look at the world of today, and if you look back at history, you will see the answer. The degree of a country's freedom is the degree of its prosperity. Another current catchphrase is the complaint that the nations of the world are divided into the haves and the have-nots. Observe that the haves are those who have freedom, and that it is freedom that the have-nots have not. If men want to oppose war, it is statism that they must oppose. So long as they hold the tribal notion that the individual is sacrificial fodder for the collective, that some men have the right to rule others by force, and that some, any, alleged good can justify it, there can be no peace within a nation and no peace among nations. It is true that nuclear weapons have made wars too horrible to contemplate, but it makes no difference to a man whether he is killed by a nuclear bomb or a dynamite bomb or an old-fashioned club. Nor does the number of other victims or the scale of the destruction make any difference to him. And there is something obscene in the attitude of those who regard horror as a matter of numbers, who are willing to send a small group of youths to die for the tribe, but scream against the danger to the tribe itself, and more, who are willing to condone the slaughter of defenseless victims, but march in protest against wars between the well-armed. So long as men are subjugated by force, they will fight back and use any weapons available. If a man is led to a Nazi gas chamber or a Soviet firing squad, with no voices raised to defend him, would he feel any love or concern for the survival of mankind? Or would he be more justified in feeling that a cannibalistic mankind, which tolerates dictatorships, does not deserve to survive? If nuclear weapons are a dreadful threat, and mankind cannot afford war any longer, then mankind cannot afford statism any longer. Let no man of goodwill take it upon his conscience to advocate the rule of force outside or inside his own country. Let all those who are actually concerned with peace, those who do love man and do care about his survival, realize that if war is ever to be outlawed, it is the use of force that has to be outlawed. Chapter 3, America's Persecuted Minority, Big Business, by Ayn Rand. If a small group of men were always regarded as guilty in any clash with any other group, regardless of the issues or circumstances involved, would you call it persecution? If this group were always made to pay for the sins, errors, or failures of any other group, would you call that persecution? If this group had to live under a silent reign of terror, under special laws from which all other people were immune, laws which the accused could not grasp or define in advance, and which the accuser could interpret in any way he pleased, would you call that persecution? If this group were penalized not for its faults but for its virtues, not for its incompetence but for its ability, not for its failures but for its achievements, and the greater the achievement, the greater the penalty, would you call that persecution? If your answer is yes, then ask yourself what sort of monstrous injustice you are condoning, supporting, or perpetrating. That group is the American businessmen. The defense of minority rights is acclaimed today virtually by everyone as a moral principle of a high order. But this principle, which forbids discrimination, is applied by most of the liberal intellectuals in a discriminatory manner. It is applied only to racial or religious minorities. It is not applied to that small, exploited, denounced, defenseless minority which consists of businessmen. Yet every ugly, brutal aspect of injustice toward racial or religious minorities is being practiced toward businessmen. For instance, consider the evil of condemning some men and absolving others without a hearing, regardless of the facts. Today's liberals consider a businessman guilty in any conflict with a labor union, regardless of the facts or issues involved, and boast that they will not cross a picket line, right or wrong. Consider the evil of judging people by a double standard, and of denying to some the rights granted to others. Today's liberals recognize the workers, the majority's right to their livelihood, their wages, but deny the businessmen's, the minority's right to their livelihood, their profits. If workers struggle for higher wages, this is hailed as social gains. If businessmen struggle for higher profits, this is damned as selfish greed. If the workers' standard of living is low, the liberals blame it on the businessmen. But if the businessmen attempt to improve their economic efficacy, to expand their markets, and to enlarge the financial returns of their enterprises, thus making higher wages and lower prices possible, the same liberals denounce it as commercialism. If a non-commercial foundation, i.e. a group which did not have to earn its funds, sponsors a television show advocating its particular views, the liberals hail it as enlightenment, education, art, and public service. If a businessman sponsors a television show and wants it to reflect his views, the liberals scream, calling it censorship, pressure, and dictatorial rule. When three locals of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters deprived New York City of its milk supply for 15 days, no moral indignation or condemnation was heard from the liberal quarters. But just imagine what would happen if businessmen stopped that milk supply for 1 hour, and how swiftly they would be struck down by that legalized lynching or pogrom known as trust busting. Whenever in any era, culture, or society you encounter the phenomenon of prejudice, injustice, persecution, and blind, unreasoning hatred directed at some minority group, look for the gang that has something to gain from that persecution. Look for those who have a vested interest in the destruction of these particular sacrificial victims. Invariably, you will find that the persecuted minority serves as a scapegoat for some movement that does not want the nature of its own goals to be known. Every movement that seeks to enslave a country, every dictatorship or potential dictatorship, needs some minority group as a scapegoat which it can blame for the nation's troubles and use as a justification of its own demands for dictatorial powers. In Soviet Russia, the scapegoat was the bourgeoisie. In Nazi Germany, it was the Jewish people. In America, it is the businessmen. America has not yet reached the stage of a dictatorship, but paving the way to it for many decades past, the businessmen have served as the scapegoat for statist movements of all kinds, communist, fascist, or welfare. For whose sins and evils did the businessmen take the blame? For the sins and evils of the bureaucrats. A disastrous intellectual package deal put over on us by the theoreticians of statism is the equation of economic power with political power. You've heard it expressed in such bromides as, "A hungry man is not free," or, "It makes no difference to a worker whether he takes orders from a businessman or from a bureaucrat." Most people accept these equivocations, and yet they know that the poorest laborer in America is freer and more secure than the richest commissar in Soviet Russia. What is the basic, the essential, the crucial principle that differentiates freedom from slavery? It is the principle of voluntary action versus physical coercion or compulsion. The difference between political power and any other kind of social power, between a government and any private organization, is the fact that a government holds a legal monopoly on the use of physical force. This distinction is so important and so seldom recognized today that I must urge you to keep it in mind. Let me repeat it. A government holds a legal monopoly on the use of physical force. No individual or private group or private organization has the legal power to initiate the use of physical force against other individuals or groups and to compel them to act against their own voluntary choice. Only a government holds that power. The nature of political power is the power to force obedience under threat of physical injury, the threat of property expropriation, imprisonment, or death. Foggy metaphors, sloppy images, unfocused poetry and equivocation such as "a hungry man is not free" do not alter the fact that only political power is the power of physical coercion and that freedom, in a political context, has only one meaning, the absence of physical coercion. The only proper function of the government of a free country is to act as an agency which protects the individual's rights, i.e., which protects the individual from physical violence. Such a government does not have the right to initiate the use of physical force against anyone, a right which the individual does not possess and therefore cannot delegate to any agency. But the individual does possess the right of self-defense, and that is the right which he delegates to the government for the purpose of an orderly, legally defined enforcement. A proper government has the right to use physical force only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. The proper functions of a government are the police, to protect men from criminals, the military forces to protect men from foreign invaders, and the law courts to protect men's property and contracts from breach by force or fraud, and to settle disputes among men according to objectively defined laws. These, implicitly, were the political principles on which the Constitution of the United States was based, implicitly but not explicitly. There were contradictions in the Constitution, which allowed the statists to gain an entering wedge, to enlarge the breach and gradually to wreck the structure. A statist is a man who believes that some men have the right to force, coerce, enslave, rob, and murder others. To be put into practice, this belief has to be implemented by the political doctrine that the government, the state, has the right to initiate the use of physical force against its citizens. How often force is to be used, against whom, to what extent, for what purpose, and for whose benefit are irrelevant questions. The basic principle and the ultimate results of all statist doctrines are the same: dictatorship and destruction. The rest is only a matter of time. Now let us consider the question of economic power. What is economic power? It is the power to produce and to trade what one has produced. In a free economy where no man or group of men can use physical coercion against anyone, economic power can be achieved only by voluntary means, by the voluntary choice and agreement of all those who participate in the process of production and trade. In a free market, all prices, wages, and profits are determined not by the arbitrary whim of the rich or of the poor, not by anyone's greed or by anyone's need, but by the law of supply and demand. The mechanism of a free market reflects and sums up all the economic choices and decisions made by all the participants. Men trade their goods or services by mutual consent to mutual advantage, according to their own independent, uncoerced judgment. A man can grow rich only if he is able to offer better values, better products or services at a lower price than others are able to offer. Wealth in a free market is achieved by a free, general, democratic vote, by the sales and the purchases of every individual who takes part in the economic life of the country. Whenever you buy one product rather than another, you are voting for the success of some manufacturer, and in this type of voting, every man votes only on those matters which he is qualified to judge, on his own preferences, interests, and needs. No one has the power to decide for others or to substitute his judgment for theirs. No one has the power to appoint himself the voice of the public and to leave the public voiceless and disfranchised. Now let me define the difference between economic power and political power. Economic power is exercised by means of a positive, by offering men a reward, an incentive, a payment of value. Political power is exercised by means of a negative, by the threat of punishment, injury, imprisonment, destruction. The businessman's tool is values, the bureaucrat's tool is fear. America's industrial progress, in the short span of a century and a half, has acquired the character of a legend. It has never been equaled anywhere on earth in any period of history. The American businessmen, as a class, have demonstrated the greatest productive genius and the most spectacular achievements ever recorded in the economic history of mankind. What reward did they receive from our culture and its intellectuals? The position of a hated, persecuted minority, the position of a scapegoat for the evils of the bureaucrats. A system of pure, unregulated laissez-faire capitalism has never yet existed anywhere. What did exist were only so-called mixed economies, which means a mixture in varying degrees of freedom and controls, of voluntary choice and government coercion, of capitalism and statism. America was the freest country on earth, but elements of statism were present in her economy from the start. These elements kept growing under the influence of her intellectuals, who were predominantly committed to the philosophy of statism. The intellectuals, the ideologists, the interpreters, the assessors of public events, were tempted by the opportunity to seize political power, relinquished by all other social groups, and to establish their own versions of a good society at the point of a gun, i.e. by means of legalized physical coercion. They denounced the free businessmen as exponents of selfish greed and glorified the bureaucrats as public servants. In evaluating social problems, they kept damning economic power and exonerating political power, thus switching the burden of guilt from the politicians to the businessmen. All the evils, abuses, and iniquities popularly ascribed to businessmen and to capitalism were not caused by an unregulated economy or by a free market, but by government intervention into the economy. The giants of American industry, such as James Jerome Hill or Commodore Vanderbilt or Andrew Carnegie or J.P. Morgan, were self-made men who earned their fortunes by personal ability, by free trade on a free market. But there existed another kind of businessmen, the products of a mixed economy, the men with political pull, who made fortunes by means of special privileges granted to them by the government, such men as the Big Four of the Central Pacific Railroad. It was the political power behind their activities, the power of forced, unearned, economically unjustified privileges, that caused dislocations in the country's economy, hardships, depressions, and mounting public protests. But it was the free market and the free businessmen that took the blame. Every calamitous consequence of government controls was used as a justification for the extension of the controls and of the government's power over the economy. If I were asked to choose the date which marks the turning point on the road to the ultimate destruction of American industry, and the most infamous piece of legislation in American history, I would choose the year 1890 and the Sherman Act, which began that grotesque, irrational, malignant growth of unenforceable, uncompliable, unjudicable contradictions known as the antitrust laws. Under the antitrust laws, a man becomes a criminal from the moment he goes into business, no matter what he does. If he complies with one of these laws, he faces criminal prosecution under several others. For instance, if he charges prices which some bureaucrats judge as too high, he can be prosecuted for monopoly, or rather, for a successful intent to monopolize. If he charges prices lower than those of his competitors, he can be prosecuted for unfair competition, or restraint of trade. And if he charges the same prices as his competitors, he can be prosecuted for collusion or conspiracy. I recommend to your attention an excellent book entitled The Antitrust Laws of the USA by A.D. Neal. It is a scholarly, dispassionate, objective study. The author, a British civil servant, is not a champion of free enterprise. As far as one can tell, he may probably be classified as a liberal. But he does not confuse facts with interpretations. He keeps them severely apart. And the facts he presents are a horror story. Mr. Neal points out that the prohibition of restraint of trade is the essence of antitrust, and that no exact definition of what constitutes restraint of trade can be given. Thus, no one can tell what the law forbids or permits one to do. The interpretation of these laws is left entirely up to the courts. A businessman or his lawyer has to study the whole body of the so-called case law, the whole record of court cases, precedents, and decisions, in order to get even a generalized idea of the current meaning of these laws. Except that the precedents may be upset and the decisions reversed tomorrow, or next week, or next year. The courts in the United States have been engaged ever since 1890 in deciding case by case exactly what the law proscribes. No broad definition can really unlock the meaning of the statute. This means that a businessman has no way of knowing in advance whether the action he takes is legal or illegal, whether he is guilty or innocent. It means that a businessman has to live under the threat of a sudden, unpredictable disaster, taking the risk of losing everything he owns or being sentenced to jail, with his career, his reputation, his property, his fortune, the achievement of his whole lifetime, left at the mercy of any ambitious young bureaucrat who, for any reason, public or private, may choose to start proceedings against him. Retroactive or ex post facto law, i.e. a law that punishes a man for an action which was not legally defined as a crime at the time he committed it, is rejected by and contrary to the entire tradition of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence. It is a form of persecution practiced only in dictatorships and forbidden by every civilized code of law. It is specifically forbidden by the United States Constitution. It is not supposed to exist in the United States, and it is not applied to anyone, except to businessmen. A case in which a man cannot know until he is convicted whether the action he took in the past was legal or illegal is certainly a case of retroactive law. I recommend to you a brilliant little book entitled 10,000 Commandments by Harold Fleming. It is written for the layman and presents in clear, simple, logical terms, with a wealth of detailed, documented evidence, such a picture of the antitrust laws that nightmare is too feeble a word to describe it. One of the hazards, writes Mr. Fleming, that sales managers must now take into account is that some policy followed today in the light of the best legal opinion may next year be reinterpreted as illegal. In such case, the crime and the penalty may be retroactive. Another kind of hazard consists in the possibility of treble damage suits, also possibly retroactive. Firms which, with the best of intentions, run afoul of the law on one of the above counts are open to treble damage suits under the antitrust laws, even though their offense was a course of conduct that everyone considered at the time quite legal as well as ethical, but that a subsequent reinterpretation of the law found to be illegal. What do businessmen say about it? In a speech entitled Guilty Before Trial, May 18, 1950, Benjamin F. Fairless, then president of the United States Steel Corporation, said, "Gentlemen, I don't have to tell you that if we persist in that kind of a system of law, and if we enforce it impartially against all offenders, virtually every business in America, big and small, is going to have to be run from Atlanta, Sing Sing, Leavenworth, or Alcatraz." The legal treatment accorded to actual criminals is much superior to that accorded to businessmen. The criminal's rights are protected by objective laws, objective procedures, objective rules of evidence. A criminal is presumed to be innocent until he is proved guilty. Only businessmen, the producers, the providers, the supporters, the atlases who carry our whole economy on their shoulders, are regarded as guilty by nature and are required to prove their innocence without any definable criteria of innocence or proof, and are left at the mercy of the whim, the favor, or the malice of any publicity-seeking politician, any scheming statist, any envious mediocrity who might chance to work his way into a bureaucratic job and who feels a yen to do some trust-busting. The better or more honorable kind of government officials have repeatedly protested against the non-objective nature of the antitrust laws. In the same speech, Mr. Fairless quotes a statement made by Lowell Mason, who was then a member of the Federal Trade Commission. "American business is being harassed, bled, and even blackjacked under a preposterous crazy quilt system of laws, many of which are unintelligible, unenforceable, and unfair. There is such a welter of laws governing interstate commerce that the government literally can find some charge to bring against any concern it chooses to prosecute. I say that this system is an outrage." Further, Mr. Fairless quotes a comment written by Supreme Court Justice Jackson when he was the head of the Antitrust Division at the Department of Justice. "It is impossible for a lawyer to determine what business conduct will be pronounced lawful by the courts. This situation is embarrassing to businessmen wishing to obey the law and to government officials attempting to enforce it." That embarrassment, however, is not shared by all members of the government. Mr. Fleming's book quotes the following statement made by Emanuel Seller, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, at a symposium of the New York State Bar Association in January 1950. I want to make it clear that I would vigorously oppose any antitrust laws that attempted to particularize violations, giving bills of particulars to replace general principles. The law must remain fluid, allowing for a dynamic society. I want to make it clear that fluid law is a euphemism for arbitrary power, that fluidity is the chief characteristic of the law under any dictatorship, and that the sort of dynamic society whose laws are so fluid that they flood and drown the country may be seen in Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. The tragic irony of that whole issue is the fact that the antitrust laws were created and to this day are supported by the so-called conservatives, by the alleged defenders of free enterprise. This is a grim proof of the fact that capitalism has never had any proper philosophical defenders, and a measure of the extent to which its alleged champions lacked any political principles, any knowledge of economics, and any understanding of the nature of political power. The concept of free competition enforced by law is a grotesque contradiction in terms. It means forcing people to be free at the point of a gun. It means protecting people's freedom by the arbitrary rule of unanswerable bureaucratic edicts. What were the historical causes that led to the passage of the Sherman Act? I quote from the book by Mr. Neal. The impetus behind the movement for the earliest legislation gathered strength during the 1870s and the 1880s. After the Civil War, the railways, with their privileges, charters, and subsidies, became the main objects of suspicion and hostility. Many bodies with revealing names like the National Anti-Monopoly Cheap Freight Railway League sprung up. This is an eloquent example of the businessmen serving as scapegoat, taking the blame for the sins of the politicians. It was the politically granted privileges, the charters and subsidies of the railroads, that people rebelled against. It was those privileges that had placed the railroads of the West outside the reach of competition and had given them a monopolistic power, with all its consequent abuses. But the remedy, written into law by a Republican Congress, consisted of destroying the businessmen's freedom and of extending the power of political controls over the economy. If you wish to observe the real American tragedy, compare the ideological motivation of the antitrust laws to their actual results. I quote from Mr. Neal's book. It seems likely that American distrust of all sources of unchecked power is a more deep-rooted and persistent motive behind the antitrust policy than any economic belief or any radical political trend. This distrust may be seen in many spheres of American life. It is expressed in the theories of checks and balances and of separation of powers. In the United States, the fact that some men possess power over the activities and fortunes of others is sometimes recognized as inevitable, but never accepted as satisfactory. It is always hoped that any particular holder of power, whether political or economic, will be subject to the threat of encroachment by other authorities. At one with this basic motivation of antitrust is its reliance on legal process and judicial remedy rather than on administrative regulation. The famous prescription of the Massachusetts Bill of Rights, "To the end it may be a government of laws and not of men," is a favorite American quotation and an essential one for understanding antitrust. Without this factor, it would be impossible to explain the degree of acceptance, so astonishing to those outside the United States, that is accorded to the antitrust policy by those interests, especially big business interests, which are frequently and expensively subject to its discipline. Here is the tragedy of what happens to human intentions without a clearly defined philosophical theory to guide their practical implementation. The first free society in history destroyed its freedom in the name of protecting freedom. The failure to differentiate between political and economic power allowed men to suppose that coercion could be a proper balance to production, that both were activities of the same order which could serve as a check on each other, that the authority of a businessman and the authority of a bureaucrat were interchangeable rivals for the same social function. Seeking a government of laws and not of men, The advocates of antitrust delivered the entire American economy into the power of as arbitrary a government of men as any dictatorship could hope to establish. In the absence of any rational criteria of judgment, people attempted to judge the immensely complex issues of a free market by so superficial a standard as bigness. You hear it to this day, big business, big government, or big labor are denounced as threats to society, with no concern for the nature, source, or function of the bigness, as if size as such were evil. This type of reasoning would mean that a big genius like Edison and a big gangster like Stalin were equal malefactors. One flooded the world with immeasurable values, and the other with incalculable slaughter. But both did it on a very big scale. I doubt whether anyone would care to equate these two, yet this is the precise difference between big business and big government. The sole means by which a government can grow big is physical force. The sole means by which a business can grow big in a free economy is productive achievement. The only actual factor required for the existence of free competition is the unhampered, unobstructed operation of the mechanism of a free market. The only action which a government can take to protect free competition is laissez-faire, which in free translation means hands off. But the antitrust laws established exactly opposite conditions and achieved the exact opposite of the results they had been intended to achieve. There is no way to legislate competition. There are no standards by which one could define who should compete with whom, how many competitors should exist in any given field, what should be their relative strength or their so-called relevant markets, what prices they should charge, what methods of competition are fair or unfair. None of these can be answered because these precisely are the questions that can be answered only by the mechanism of a free market. With no principles, standards, or criteria to guide it, the antitrust case law is the record of 70 years of sophistry, casuistry, and hair-splitting, as absurd and as removed from any contact with reality as the debates of medieval scholastics, with only this difference: the scholastics had better reasons for the questions they raised, and no specific human lives or fortunes hung on the outcome of their debates. Let me give you a few examples of antitrust cases. In the case of Associated Press v. United States of 1945, the Associated Press was found guilty because its bylaws restricted its membership and made it very difficult for newly established newspapers to join. I quote from Mr. Neal's book. It was argued in defense of the Associated Press that there were other news agencies from which new entrants might draw their news. The court held that Associated Press was collectively organized to secure competitive advantages for members over non-members, and as such was in restraint of trade, even though the non-members were not necessarily prevented altogether from competing. The Associated Press news service was considered so important a facility that, by keeping it exclusive to themselves, the members of the association impose a real hardship on would-be competitors. It is no defense that the members have built up a facility for themselves. New entrants must still be allowed to share it on reasonable terms unless it is practicable for them to compete without it. Whose rights are here being violated, and whose whim is being implemented by the power of the law? What qualifies one to be a would-be competitor? If I decided to start competing with General Motors tomorrow, what part of their facilities would they have to share with me in order to make it practicable for me to compete with them? In the case of Milgram v. Lowe's of 1951, the consistent refusal of the major distributors of motion pictures to grant first runs to a drive-in theater was held to be a proof of collusion. Each company had obviously valid reasons for its refusal, and the defense argued that each had made its own independent decision without knowing the decisions of the others. But the court ruled that consciously parallel business practices are sufficient proof of conspiracy, and that further proof of actual agreement among the defendants is unnecessary. The Court of Appeals upheld this decision, suggesting that evidence of parallel action should transfer the burden of proof to the defendants to explain away the inference of joint action, which they had not apparently explained away. Consider for a moment the implications of this case. If three businessmen reach independently the same blatantly obvious business decision, do they then have to prove that they did not conspire? Or if two businessmen observe an intelligent business policy originated by the third, should they refrain from adopting it for fear of a conspiracy charge? Or if they do adopt it, should he then find himself dragged into court and charged with conspiracy on the ground of the actions taken by two men he had never heard of? And how then is he to explain away his presumed guilt and prove himself innocent? In the case of patents, the antitrust laws seem to respect the patent owner's right, so long as he is alone in using his patent and does not share it with anyone else. But if he decides not to engage in a patent war with a competitor who holds patents of the same general category, if they both decide to abandon that alleged dog-eat-dog policy of which businessmen are so often accused, if they decide to pool their patents and license them to a few other manufacturers of their own choice, then the antitrust laws crack down on them both. The penalties in such patent pool cases involve compulsory licensing of the patents to any and all comers, or the outright confiscation of the patents. I quote from Mr. Neal's book. The compulsory licensing of patents, even valid patents lawfully acquired through the research efforts of the company's own employees, is intended not as punishment, but as a way in which rival companies may be brought into the market. In the ICI and DuPont case of 1952, for example, Judge Ryan ordered the compulsory licensing of their existing patents in the fields to which their restrictive agreements applied, and improvement patents, but not new patents, in these fields. In this case, an auxiliary remedy was awarded, which has become common in recent years. Both ICI and DuPont were charged to provide applicants, at a reasonable charge, with technical manuals which would show in detail how the patents were practiced. This, mind you, is not regarded as punitive. Whose mind, ability, achievement, and rights are here sacrificed, and for whose unearned benefit? The most shocking court decision in this grim progression, up to but not including the year 1961, was written, as one would almost expect, by a distinguished conservative, Judge Learned Hand. The victim was Alcoa. The case was United States v. Aluminum Company of America of 1945. Under the antitrust laws, monopoly as such is not illegal. What is illegal is the intent to monopolize. To find Alcoa guilty, Judge Learned Hand had to find evidence that Alcoa had taken aggressive action to exclude competitors from its market. Here is the kind of evidence which he found, and on which he based the ruling that has blocked the energy of one of America's greatest industrial concerns. I quote from Judge Hand's opinion. It was not inevitable that it, Alcoa, should always anticipate increases in the demand for ingot and be prepared to supply them. Nothing compelled it to keep doubling and redoubling its capacity before others entered the field. It insists that it never excluded competitors, but we can think of no more effective exclusion than progressively to embrace each new opportunity as it opened and to face every newcomer with new capacity already geared into a great organization, having the advantage of experience, trade connections, and the elite of personnel. Here, the meaning and purpose of the antitrust laws comes blatantly and explicitly into the open, the only meaning and purpose these laws could have, whether their authors intended it or not. The penalizing of ability for being ability, the penalizing of success for being success, and the sacrifice of productive genius to the demands of envious mediocrity. If such a principle were applied to all productive activity, if a man of intelligence were forbidden to embrace each new opportunity as it opened for fear of discouraging some coward or fool who might wish to compete with him, it would mean that none of us in any profession should venture forward or rise or improve because any form of personal progress, be it a typist's greater speed or an artist's greater canvas or a doctor's greater percentage of cures, can discourage the kind of newcomers who haven't yet started but who expect to start competing at the top. As a small but crowning touch, I will quote Mr. Neal's footnote to his account of the Alcoa case. It is of some interest to note that the main ground on which economic writers have condemned the aluminum monopoly has been precisely that Alcoa consistently failed to embrace opportunities for expansion, and so underestimated the demand for the metal that the United States was woefully short of productive capacity at the outset of both world wars. Now I will ask you to bear in mind the nature, the essence, and the record of the antitrust laws when I mention the ultimate climax which makes the rest of that sordid record seem insignificant, the General Electric case of 1961. The list of the accused in that case reads like a roll call of honor of the electrical equipment industry: General Electric, Westinghouse, Alice Chalmers, and 26 other smaller companies. Their crime was that they had provided you with all the matchless benefits and comforts of the electrical age, from bread toasters to power generators. It is for this crime that they were punished, because they could not have provided any of it nor remained in business without breaking the antitrust laws. The charge against them was that they had made secret agreements to fix the prices of their products and to rig bids. But without such agreements, the larger companies could have set their prices so low that the smaller ones would have been unable to match them and would have gone out of business, whereupon the larger companies would have faced prosecution under these same antitrust laws for intent to monopolize. I quote from an article by Richard Austin Smith entitled "The Incredible Electrical Conspiracy" in Fortune, April and May 1961. If GE were to drive for 50% of the market, even strong companies like ITE Circuit Breaker might be mortally wounded. This same article shows that the price-fixing agreements did not benefit General Electric, that they worked to its disadvantage, that General Electric was in effect the sucker, and that its executives knew it, wanted to leave the conspiracy but had no choice, by reason of antitrust and other government regulations. The best evidence of the fact that the antitrust laws were a major factor in forcing the conspiracy upon the electrical industry can be seen in the aftermath of that case, in the issue of the consent decree. When General Electric announced that it now intended to charge the lowest prices possible, it was the smaller companies and the government, the antitrust division, who objected. Mr. Smith's article mentions the fact that the meetings of the conspirators started as a result of the OPA. During the war, the prices of electrical equipment were fixed by the government, and the executives of the electrical industry held meetings to discuss a common policy. They continued this practice after the OPA was abolished. By what conceivable standard can the policy of price fixing be a crime when practiced by businessmen, but a public benefit when practiced by the government? There are many industries in peacetime, trucking for instance, whose prices are fixed by the government. If price fixing is harmful to competition, to industry, to production, to consumers, to the whole economy, and to the public interest, as the advocates of the antitrust laws have claimed, then how can that same harmful policy become beneficial in the hands of the government? Since there is no rational answer to this question, I suggest that you question the economic knowledge, the purpose, and the motives of the champions of antitrust. The electrical companies offered no defense to the charge of conspiracy. They pleaded nolo contendere, which means no contest. They did it because the antitrust laws place so deadly a danger in the path of any attempt to defend oneself that defense becomes virtually impossible. These laws provide that a company convicted of an antitrust violation can be sued for treble damages by any customer who might claim that he was injured. In a case of so large a scale as the electrical industry case, such treble damage suits could conceivably wipe all the defendants out of existence. With that kind of threat hanging over him, who can or will take the risk of offering a defense in a court where there are no objective laws, no objective standards of guilt or innocence, no objective way to estimate one's chances? Try to project what clamor of indignation and what protests would be heard publicly all around us if some other group of men, some other minority group, were subjected to a trial in which defense was made impossible, or in which the laws prescribed that the more serious the offense, the more dangerous the defense. Certainly the opposite is true in regard to actual criminals. The more serious the crime, the greater the precautions and protections prescribed by the law to give the defendant a chance and the benefit of every doubt. It is only businessmen who have to come to court bound and gagged. Now, what started the government's investigation of the electrical industry? Mr. Smith's article states that the investigation was started because of complaints by TVA and demands by Senator Kefauver. This was in 1959 under Eisenhower's Republican administration. I quote from Time of February 17, 1961. Often the government has a hard time gathering evidence in antitrust cases, but this time it got a break. In October 1959, four Ohio businessmen were sentenced to jail after pleading nolo contendere in an antitrust case. One of them committed suicide on the way to jail. This news sent a chill through the electrical equipment executives under investigation, and some agreed to testify about their colleagues under the security of immunity. With the evidence gathered from them, most are still with their companies, the government sewed up its case. It is not gangsters, racketeers, or dope peddlers that are here being discussed in such terms, but businessmen, the productive, creative, efficient, competent members of society. Yet the antitrust laws, now, in this new phase, are apparently aimed at transforming business into an underworld, with informers, stool pigeons, double-crossers, special deals, and all the rest of the atmosphere of the untouchables. Seven executives of the electrical industry were sentenced to jail. We shall never know what went on behind the scenes of this case, or in the negotiations between the companies and the government. Were these seven responsible for the alleged conspiracy? If it be guilt, were they guiltier than others? Who informed on them? And why? Were they framed? Were they double-crossed? Whose purposes, ambitions, or goals were served by their immolation? This book is continued on Disc 3.